No, if the psychic entity has been from the beginning unveiled 8, 9 years ago.
Okay. Right. It is the 9:27 in the other pool.
So just to sum up briefly, here Sri Aurobindo is making the point that, see, there are two movements that have been going on, or two evolutions. One is the evolution of nature, which has been preparing its instruments for some higher expression and taking it from species to species, arriving at the human being. But that evolution is also not complete in the sense that the human being, in its powers and potentials, is still being integrated. So that is an unfinished project of nature on the one hand. And on the other hand, within that, the soul which has been evolving, the yoga or evolution of Purusha, has reached a certain point where it is on the verge of waking up. It's as if it's in maturity, in power of its own reality. It has reached a critical mass, at which point it can become truly self-conscious. So that amplitude of consciousness, if you want to call it that, that is arrived at the human level, enables the soul to seek for its own reality or truth, which it finds itself imprisoned by nature around it. So evolution or yoga of nature, which is proceeding as one dimension or direction, is not properly, so to say, in harmony with the emergence of soul in the human being. So soul in the human being, and by soul I mean over here the inner entity as it emerges. Now the soul entity in its emergence has a certain effect on the nature, the subliminal parts of the nature. Therefore it is that effect which we experience as the expression of the soul. That effect, however, is on the individual nature. Sense of individuality develops because of this critical mass to which the soul has arrived. And therefore, human beings have a very distinct sense of the ego. Now, that is nature's distortion, you may say, of a separative personality. But it is through that Purusha makes its emergence felt and, so to say, drives it towards a certain expression of its own truth. Now, that emergence causes a certain disjuncture or disharmony to be experienced by the human being between the self and nature. This disharmony is experienced in a variety of ways, but this is part of what is called the human condition. So one experience arising out of that human condition is to seek to emerge as a soul in its fullness and escape from the determining power of nature. Now, this is held to be spirituality. And in the previous paragraph and previous chapter, Sri Aurobindo has talked about the emergence of or evolution of the spiritual man. The evolution of the spiritual man is the arrival at this point where soul feels in whatever way in the nature that it can be free from the determining powers of nature. So then a variety of disciplines are undertaken, and that particular feeling, which I may call a faith, drives the the being into its spiritual destiny. Now, Sri Aurobindo begins this particular chapter with that understanding, but he says that that spiritual destiny, if it ends up being just a question of emergence out of nature, manages its own freedom all right, but it has denied nature's yoga. What was it that was bringing it to that particular point where it could emerge and know its own freedom? It wasn't just to escape from nature, but to complete nature's yoga. This is the very important point that Sri Aurobindo is making over here, that indeed it's almost as if you are being enabled, you know, by a certain universal force to arrive at a certain degree of expression, and at that point, dissatisfied with whatever has been achieved, you use your freedom to get away from that which you could expect. So, Sri Aurobindo talks over there about the paragraph on a second, I think the paragraph, this is because the principle of spirituality has yet to affirm itself in its own complete right and sovereignty. So here, essentially, he's saying that this juncture is arising because nature has not gone far enough, has not completed sufficiently her own preparation for the spiritual expression. The instruments are not yet prepared. There is a beginning of these instruments. And what is that beginning? Well, I would say what he means by that is all of us have some kind of psychic being. The soul personality is developed to some degree in all of us, number one. Number two, all of us have some degree of subliminal being, that is, inner mental, vital, physical being, and part of it under the control of some higher principle, either Purusha, mental, vital, physical Purusha, or psychic influence, or some higher power which is acting in it. So, inner instrument or inner being, Antahkarana, is under preparation, you may say, to express or to experience and express higher consciousness. Number three, principle of mind in its ascent has reached a certain point where to varying degrees in varying human beings, there is appearing an opening to intuitive powers. So the preparation of an intuitive mind is also in the making. So these various powers of nature which are in the making are instruments that ultimately can become those natural powers of expression through which soul can express itself. But in the meantime, soul acting on mind can create a certain impatience there, an impression as if it is in prison, and therefore an attempt to deny the instruments and allow soul to escape. Now, what the point he's making in that paragraph is, after talking about the development of another instrumentation has begun but is not yet has yet to become total and effective. The next part is very important. It has decided to cease to be a purely individual self-creation in an original ignorance, something supernormal to earth life that must always be acquired as an individual achievement by a difficult endeavor. It must become the normal nature of a new type of being. As mind is established here on a basis of ignorance, seeking for knowledge and growing into knowledge, so supermind must be established here on a basis of knowledge, growing into its own greater light. This is a very key aspect of this whole chapter, which is essentially the most firm foundation of Sri Aurobindo's own work, which is that it is not undertaken as an individual either to escape from the nature or as an individual to fulfill those powers of expression which HS seeks to fulfill by creating some kind of freak instrumentality. But to bring into nature itself or out of nature's latency those powers that would make this kind of image of a human a natural reality of the future. That is a new anthropology, you may say. A new norm or definition of the human must arise. This is essentially the point he's making over here. And then in a nutshell, he's giving us the three steps necessary to make that possible. It's a very big tall order, as one may say, because he says that the bridge has not been built. The gulf between mind and supermind has to be bridged, the closed passages opened, and the roads of ascent and descent created, where there is now a void and a silence. If we are to enter into these zones in between, then we'll fall into a Sushupti, or what we'll take to be a complete Nirvikalpa Samadhi. That would be our normal condition, because that bridge has not been built. Were the bridge built, it would be a different kind of experience. The experience of a wakeful human expression or supramental expression in nature. So then he moves on that one paragraph, that last paragraph is, he starts off talking about the psychic transformation, or at least about the psychic being. So the triple transformation consists in bringing the psychic being to the front, and transforming the whole of the nature in by it, then by opening up this nature to the spiritual being or overmental being, and its cosmic consciousness and powers of light, knowledge, power, force, bliss, and purity to transform the individual nature, individual sort of self, reside in union with the cosmic Purusha, and finally open up the veil of the supramental Purusha, attain to union with it, identity with it, and transform the entire individual nature, in a sense also becoming the radiation of a universal action in earth nature of the supramental consciousness. So having established that, now he's talking about the psychic entity and the fact of its own evolution. How does the psychic entity evolve out of a certain density of ignorance and coming into greater and greater power of its own reality and power over nature?
So Devashisda, in the beginning of the page, when he talks about how it should not necessarily be a difficult endeavor by each human, but it should be normal to the consciousness, so to say. So he is indeed envisaging a world where it is fairly effortless. That is, the psychic consciousness is normal, is the normal makeup of the human. Correct.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, he is talking about that as the norm towards which we must evolve. And this thing where he's saying that something supernormal to earth life that must always be acquired as an individual achievement by a difficult endeavor, where he's saying that should not be the case. It has decided to cease to be a purely individual self-creation in an original ignorance, something supernormal to earth life that must always be acquired as an individual achievement by a difficult endeavor. That particular sentence, you have to read it in a way in which it relates to the idea of the descent of necessity for the descent of consciousness. In Now, as he has said, if, let's say, by power of some kind of grace, some sort of supernatural action, by the action of other powers, the gods, or by the action of individual tapas, one were to bring down into one's personal nature some of these lost instrumentations, let's call them, then what would happen is that we would be able to maintain it in our own nature by yoga siddhi. Okay? By yoga siddhi. Now, that would have some, effect on the individual. But every individual, that could have no real lasting effect. It might have some temporary and relative effect on the nature that is around this individual. But it could have no lasting effect in nature. At most, the path hewn by this person would become a certain kind of teaching which others would have to carry out in its fullness in their own lives through hard tapas, through hard endeavor. I think Eka wants to be added. She's got dropped off, is it?
Could be. I'm just adding her. Last time she didn't accept, but perhaps it will be better this time.
So that point that Sri Aurobindo has made of an evolutionary nature, that if, however, this power from above opens up its own potency that is latent within nature, within the cosmos, then this becomes a widespread natural manifestation. The principle of supermind becomes active in nature and starts creating its own instruments. See, that incomplete work that nature has begun is so, in fact, because nature does not have it within its own power to wake up the hidden supermind within it. Therefore, that pressure from above and from within will make it create approximations which will always be imperfect. To arrive at something which is perfect, you have to bring that power itself into nature's own working. And that is done by the descent of the supermental power, which enters into nature's own universal or cosmic consciousness and opens up its own potency within, so that a materialized supramental action can take place, a supramental action based in the principle of matter. Now, if that happens, that can only happen if whoever it is trying to create by yoga siddhi this particular instrumentation, does so in a way in which this person is in identity with the cosmic Purusha and cosmic Prakriti. That complete cosmic consciousness can make it possible for a higher principle to enter and open up, because there is the power of identity at the universal level. It can open up its own potencies within. And then it becomes an action or a part of nature itself, part of nature's evolution, not a freak that by yoga siddhi somebody can or has to maintain, but action of yoga's evolution itself, and something that human beings in the future would find easier to accomplish.
In what way this individual effort occurs? going to be different from the tuples of the series of the past. Is there any difference in the main emphasis different, or what is different between these two words?
Well, there's a couple of things that one may say are different. One is that idea of triple transformation, we talked about this last time, idea of triple transformation proceeds through the making, through the identity of individual Purusha with cosmic Purusha. As a result of this, there has to be an assimilation of the planes of cosmic consciousness. So there has to be a growth into the planes of mind above the mind, and ultimately an entry into overmind. Now, this has not necessarily been attempted by yogis in the past, because they felt that they had to jump beyond avidya. The completion of avidya in themselves, there is a part that Sri Aurobindo is saying, we must embrace the maya of the ignorance and then exceed her. So that embracing of the maya of the ignorance has not been, accepted as a legitimate goal of yoga sadhana by most people in the past. They have sought to exceed nature from the very beginning. As a result, whatever power they have brought down has been only an individual power and has not had effects on cosmic nature. That is one problem. And I wouldn't say this is the case with everybody, because the Vedic seers were trying to do that. They understood, as far as I know, from Sri Aurobindo, they understood the meaning of this triple transformation. Now, the second problem is that cosmic nature itself has to be ready so that it can receive the power that is descending and make it a part of its natural action. So that was not the case in the past. This is the reason why, Sri Aurobindo says, Vedic rishis knew about this secret and tried to bring it down, but saw that cosmic prakriti was not ready to accept it, was not in a position. Preparation was not enough. Preparation has to be through two levels. One is cosmic prakriti in her own evolution has to evolve power of consciousness in the species that is sufficiently ready. That includes, in a major way, human species. Now, number two, human species itself must have the aspiration that has arisen to a sufficient degree that is calling this particular power down. So now, this was not the case in the past. This is the second aspect, the aspect of nature's preparation, is in some sense only fully done now. That is at least what Sri Aurobindo is saying. This is the age where humanity has been integrated to that extent, made into a quote-unquote human consciousness, so that various different aspects of humanity are being integrated and mentality is being made common. So one of the reasons why, today's world, we may say, is so materialistic, etc., the mental power in some sense is, if you look at cultures of the past, you see the achievements of modern man seem to be in some way, much more mundane. One of the reasons that that is the case is that at this stage of nature's evolution, mentality is being truly universalized. The other side of this problem, this equation, though we may say that modern man's output is more mundane, never before have so many human beings at large, been educated, at least literate. You see, and the drive to bring literacy to all human beings, to make them exercise their minds, at least in a modicum way, has never been so strong as today. So these are signs that nature is universalizing the power of mind, establishing it at the human level, universally. Beyond that, mind's higher ranges also reached a certain kind of sense that mind cannot go further. See, if mind is to go further, it has to go way beyond its own capacity into ranges of imagination and intuition and cosmic mentality that only the very rare beings have attained. In its natural working, mind is at the end of its tether. So these are signs that now is the time when nature in her yoga has reached the point where its own consciousness is calling for the descent, not in an individual, but in a universal sense of a higher power of consciousness. If individual can unite with cosmic Purusha, then individual embodies that nature's yearning. See, this is what happens in Sri Aurobindo's Savitri. Ashwapati unites with nature's yearning. That is that is how he brings down what he's bringing down, not for himself, but for the entire nature, whose principle of aspiration has become embodied in you.
There is a certain message by the mother. Maybe it was 1969, 1st January, when she said that nature has consented to cooperate. Is that the same thing you're talking about? The flourishing of the mind in general?
It's part of that same thing. There is no doubt that is part of that same thing. What the mother is saying, that very powerful message. Material mother nature, thou has said that thou wilt collaborate, and there is no end to something, to the wonders of that collaboration, something like that, or that manifestation. Now, essentially, she has herself commented on this, and yeah, you can say exactly what you're saying, that is, the power of material consciousness is now receptive to the working of the supramental force within it. And once that happens, then, you know, that's why there are two levels at which this must happen. It must happen at the level of material nature itself. And it must happen at the level of human consciousness as well. Both of the receptivities are necessary. Perhaps material mother is more receptive than the human consciousness. Human consciousness is still really struggling to accept the need for this higher principle. Material consciousness is in some way speeding so quickly that mankind is being molded by forces that are way beyond his own control in today's world.
Do you say this because you are observing certain natural factors, for example, the big wars and all these movements of democracy and economy and all that, or is it somewhere that mother has said this?
No, mother, I don't know if mother has said this, actually. But mother has talked in a variety of places about the lack of receptivity of human beings to this force. That she has mentioned in a number of places, firstly in very radical and urgent ways. Firstly, when Sri Aurobindo left the body, she mentioned that as one of the main causes for his leaving the body. Secondly, when the supramental descent occurred, she mentioned that as an alarming and astounding factor that she experienced. But nobody could even know that it had happened when she thought that it would make everybody fall flat with its impact and power. Thirdly, because she talked in the last years of her life repeatedly about the lack of the need to know in human beings, that somehow all the people, large numbers of the people who are coming to her have a tremendous opportunity, but very few of them recognize what opportunity they have in coming into her presence. That fact she makes very clear. Now all this, and this is only she's talking about those around her. Think of the entire world and the fact that, you know, as Kirit Joshi was saying some time back, somehow mankind is just refusing to open to something greater. It's almost as if we know that whatever we have is not enough, but still we refuse to admit that there can be something greater. It is that denial of the aspiration which is the factor for this lack of receptivity in human beings.
And how do we know that material nature has gone beyond this?
No, we don't know. I'm just making the assumption on the basis that the secrets of matter are revealing themselves in a way going far beyond the human capacity to understand it. You see, because in a way we can look at it, you know, there is what is called complexity theory these days. And part of complexity theory says that mankind in the development of his own powers, or any level of consciousness, you may say, any phenomenon, in the development of its own powers, reaches a point of complexity where it cascades out of control and becomes chaotic. That becoming chaotic, however, is not necessarily a kind of a fall into a lower condition, but maybe the onset of a universal state of a higher order. Now, this then is some other power, like nature's own, push beyond, the power of the species that is being used to do it. So something similar seems to be happening today, in that the cascading effect of integrated technologies is creating a certain world condition that is beyond any particular individual researcher, thinker, or visionary to really predict. So what would be the ends of that? And it's scary from a certain point of view, because mankind wants to have control over his own reality. And there is a very strong sense among the thinkers and visionaries of today that we are no longer in control. So what is in control? And it's whatever is in control, is it benign or malign? Is it going to come to our own extinction, or is it going to come to some higher power? We really don't know. Only thing we can say is, and actually the mother talks about this too. It's a very interesting passage in the agenda, where she's saying, unless mankind progresses, the progress of universal nature will open up certain secrets which mankind will not be able to handle. So it's almost said that the supramental in its progress will just indiscriminately at one level, at level of nature, open up its own powers, because material mother has chosen to do so. But at each step, Purusha has to consent, and Purusha's consent Purusha may consent, but human nature, human ego, which is the exteriorization of Purusha and Prakriti, has to open up to the need, to understand that need.
It's actually very tricky, right? Like when you're saying embracing the nature or whatever that some we need to do or ego needs to do, that has to include the mind also, right? Like mind has to cooperate. And that, even the mind...
That is what I meant, that the mind has to cooperate. When I said... What I meant by the ego has to wake up, basically that's what I meant, that there has to be the consent of the nature and the external personality, the personality that we take ourselves to be, which is part of the mental personality. That has to give its consent. It has to say, yes, this is what is desirable to do. Then the consent of Purusha becomes active in the nature. Otherwise, nature will completely, sort of defeat the purpose of evolution.
So basically what you're saying, mind has to cooperate. In other words, it has to recognize that I'll have to give up. Is that all?
Yeah, indeed. Like mind has to suddenly, an aspiration has to enter mind, where it is, you see, idea of mind giving up is not really just a suicide, but mind recognizes the fact that there is a higher power because it is there in the atmosphere. It is not just a mental concept. The inner mind can experience its quality and feel that, okay, there is something here that I can open myself to and become its instrument. The teaching is also here. The power is also here. Why is there no consent to make that offering, surrender of its own reality? At some level, there is a clinging to its own ego reality, in spite of the pressure that is being felt by evolutionary nature.
And that is exactly, I mean, like when you just hit upon that word reality, I was thinking that this kind of moving from one direction to another direction or choosing one over the other kind of thing, ultimately it boils down to that accepting reality of one thing and recognizing the unreality of another thing, right?
True.
So that from that point of view, from mental principle, I mean, is it? I mean, one of the ways could be that, you know, it recognizes that becoming, or I mean, is phenomenal, and it actually doesn't have as much as much reality. I mean, it even if it does, then it is only at that moment, and it doesn't hold the reality in the next moment, sort of thing. So basically it is, I'm talking about the liberation from Prakriti. Instead of embracing Prakriti to start with, one liberation is also needed, right? For the mind to operate in that direction. Isn't that true?
Yeah, no doubt. When I said embrace Prakriti, he's not talking about embracing the lower Prakriti of nature, but he's talking about embracing the cosmic Prakriti. What point I was said that the overmind Maya is what he calls it. So the point I was trying to make over there is that what the sages have done or the yogis have done by and large is they've called the entire principle of mind to be avidya, ignorance, and therefore shot out beyond it or entered into a trance of sushupti which denied it completely. But on the other hand, mind itself has a truth, just like we were saying, mind's reality. Mind's reality is not, as we experience it, is not mind's absolute reality. It's only the relative reality in a certain density of ignorance that it experiences as its reality. Now, that mind reality itself can be influenced by either a higher mind consciousness or an inner mind consciousness, which changes its reality, in other words, makes it recognize the fact that it opens up to the cosmic planes of mind. The further higher we go in terms of the cosmic operations of mind, that kind of consciousness is naturally attuned to making itself an instrument, making itself a receptive, silent, intuitive, etc. So, development of an intuitive mentality becomes possible when what we take to be the reality of mind, or what mind, human mind, takes to be its own reality, seeds ground to the understanding of its own reality at a higher level.
The Bhishma. Coming back to the mother's message on, I think it was 1st January 1969, she said that the supramental has descended into the physical nature. Is that the same message that the material mother has decided to collaborate?
I'm not sure whether that is the same year in which that message was given. 1969, 1st January, she has later talked about the special experience she had over there on that occasion as the descent of the Superman consciousness. And in a way, she has talked about it as, you know, the Purusha of the intermediate being. That is supramental. You see, the difference that both Sri Aurobindo and Mother make between supramental being or supramental Purusha, supramental being, and the Superman principle is that the supramental principle or supramental Purusha is beyond the human. It's a species in itself. You see, or rather, it can manifest a species in itself. But if mankind is to evolve into the supramental life, then there has to be an intermediate species. That actually, that's the reason why George von Brecken has translated the term Sur-Om into Overman rather than Superman. So that what happened in 1st January 1969, she said, was the descent of the the Overman principle, if you want to use that, Sur-Om. So Sur-Om is essentially the Purusha of that intermediate being. In a way, the mother's statements from 1956 to 1973 are so in advance of human understanding that we just have to take them as mantras of the future. So I cannot really say what the total implications of what she said were, except that that's how she referred to it.
So, Dabashita, if physical mother or material mother has consented to collaborate, what about the force of life?
No, force of life, you see, actually, when she says material mother, mother nature, thou hast said thou wilt collaborate, she's talking of the fact that matter is the base. Earthly evolution needs matter's consent. Life is also manifesting in matter. Life, mind, etc. manifesting in matter. Material manifestation means that material structures, just as brain was built up, okay? Similarly, just at this point, matter in some way is collaborating with the supramental principle to build up material manifestations of the supermind. Now, what that means in terms of whether it's talking about some kind of species coming, whether it's just talking about aiding the human being, you see, because, you see, even if you think about the 60s from that time onwards to today, mankind's knowledge of matter has increased tremendously, and also power over matter has increased tremendously. So, the secrets of matter are being rendered bare, you see. So, it's possible that matter is yielding up its own powers, secrets, so that it makes itself more available for conscious handling, available to consciousness, available to other powers of consciousness for handling.
So, we are making a distinction between human beings and material mother.
Yeah, surely we are making that distinction. Because material, again, it comes down to what I was saying about the two evolutions going on. There is an evolution of prakriti or nature and an evolution of purusha. Human being is not entirely determined by the evolution of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Human being has created a rupture from nature. Mm-hmm. This is one of the first things that humanity realizes, we are not in harmony with nature's evolution. We've gone out of step. And that going out of step is not yet finding another principle of harmony within ourselves. That's why we are such odd beings on this earth.
But this also means our Prakriti part is evolving faster than our Purusha part.
Because not necessarily.
Our Prakriti is part of Mother Nature, right?
Huh?
Our prakriti is part of Mother Nature, who has consented to collaborate.
Mother Nature has consented to collaborate, but our Prakriti, just as you see new principles emerge in matter, with the emergence of life. New principles emerge in matter with the emergence of mind. With the emergence of the human, the principle of materialized life undergoes a certain degree of change. So matter, life and mind in the human being is no longer under the complete control of material nature.
Mm-hmm.
Say, like, much more to that extent, say, animals would be.
Okay, so human being as a whole, his Prakriti and his Purusha is not evolving as much as he should.
Perhaps.
In fact, this thought came to mind that this the principle of mind, right? Like, as you're saying that life is manifesting in matter, and whatever things are manifesting in matter, right? But at the same time, mind is also, I mean, like, mental principle is also manifested by matter, life, and mind, right?
Yeah.
The whole this manifestation is about order and harmony, which is actually a primary principle of mind, right? Organizing, linking and all that.
Could you elaborate that? What were you trying to say?
I mean, what I mean is that, for example, if you think of, in philosophical terms, like the Satchidananda is, existence, consciousness and bliss, whereas supermind has diffusion and comprehension, apprehension, linking, organizing, order, harmony. All these principles are actually, I'm not really talking about human mind. I'm talking about when we refer to, like, something has a mind of its own. What we really refer to is that it has some kind of arrangement and order and linking together, and which has a beginning and conclusion, whatever. A flow. Like a network
or
I don't know how to put it.
Yes.
So that principle is also what is actually at the root of this manifestation, right? Which is manifested by matter, life, mind, all the grades.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And actually what you're saying, we can take that into this discussion that you're just having about nature's yoga and the human yoga. Because in a sense, it is exactly that. Now, if we talk about globalism, for example, or if we talk about the regime of mind in contemporary times, this attempt to order everything, to bring it to a certain kind of form of integration, is a very powerful force in the world today. It is happening all over, and yet at the same time, the individual consciousness is not in any way equal to it. It's just like a kind of a cell in this entire process, you see. So we may say from a certain point of view, for good or for bad, there is a tremendous power of universalization and integration which is at work. It is taking place due to a variety of human motives, which are hardly very noble. It's taking place due to, for one, is a really interesting kind of, parallel to this whole thing is the rising of the internet out of the Department of Defense. So it's our motives of war, our motives of competition, our motives of capitalism that are spawning this kind of, tremendous amount of integration of this world. But if we look at it from nature's point of view, nature's Prakriti's yoga is being furthered by it tremendously. It's creating a certain kind of order. But from Purusha's point of view, human consciousness is hardly measuring up to the universality that is being manifested by Prakriti.
Okay, so you are saying that that mental principle, a manifestation of that mental principle or mental is actually the term, using the term mental is kind of confusing, but yet I think you know what I'm talking about. So that principle of order or organization, that manifestation of that in the cosmic nature is much more advanced than our individual individual growth in the same principle, you mean?
Correct. For example, at the individual level, you can look at it at a variety, from a variety of manifestations or expressions of the individual consciousness. Individual consciousness can today, individual mind at one level can attain to universal knowledge. It is possible, because even at the level of content, you know, mankind's human mind can stretch itself to absorb enormous amount of information and knowledge and synthesize it into a kind of universal knowledge. It's much more possible than it was ever before. Number two, human consciousness beyond that content level also can expand itself, or actually it's being demanded of it to expand itself and experience its own universality beyond national borders, beyond, you know, upbringing, beyond favoritism of various kind. That universal man, Vishwamanav, is really calling us today. And yet, we are not giving the answer to that. We are basically continuing to use all these tools of universality to further our little everyday lives, you know, and that is being promoted by the forces of capitalism that want to keep us like a dwarf humanity, you see. So at the human individual level, that epic scale that is being manifest by universal nature is nowhere in evidence.
So, one more thing, that, you know, the nature's harmony is a primordial, I mean, like, much more ancient fact than human harmony, like, right? Like, it had to start with some kind of harmony, even to start the manifestation, right?
Yes, complete.
Yeah, so basically it's like human beings have to invade and then replay, I mean, in, you know, gather that harmony back for the nature. Like, first it has to invade, right? If it is content with the nature's harmony, it will be like that forever.
Quite true. Absolutely.
So, having that said, I mean, when you're saying that there is a call from that over man, which we are putting our, you know, deaf ears to, what is that then? I mean, is it like human beings have invaded and as a result it is a response of Mother Nature? Or is it few individuals' aspirations, or maybe two individuals' aspirations like Shravindan's mother, which has propagated and at least, say for example, you are at least saying that there is a call of such kind, which we are not listening to. Even this idea, I mean, even this very uttering this statement itself is coming from some kind of development of some individuals, don't you think?
No, and I agree. Actually, you see, to answer your question, I think on the one hand, nature herself has, like Sri Aurobindo said in that paragraph, nature has prepared some secret instrumentation. So at the nature level also, apart from whatever nature is manifesting on the surface, some secret preparation is there. And we may say that due to that secret preparation, Sri Aurobindo and Mother can be born. Also, due to that secret preparation, apart from Sri Aurobindo and the Mother also, people have aspired for it. There have been people. You know, you see, if you look at the history of philosophy, this kind of idea has arisen, particularly in the 19th century. Idea of an evolution and a rupture and something higher which is to come down, others have received it as intuitions. So the intuition is the first step, I feel, towards the individual consciousness becoming, exceeding itself and becoming truly universal. Now, that may have created the conditions for two exceptional beings to arise, and whatever they have done has caused much more powerful emergence of this Purusha, this overman, in a potential to make its demand on the human. So I think that has happened. And I would also agree with you that it is not that it is completely being ignored by human beings. It is also very true that nature has her own pace, and that pace has to be invaded, as you put it, by humans who are not satisfied by it. And so that, you know, is beyond this present action of nature. A higher action of nature, that's why the whole effort of Sri Aurobindo has been to open us to that higher action, that he has opened up the, exactly what he's saying, the closed passages opened and roads of ascent and descent created, where there is now a void and silence. Where did that, you know, that road, how did it appear? It was not there to that extent before. Nobody before was talking about opening to Parashakti from above or overman consciousness from above, which would like a magnet draw us there. So this path has been opened up in modern times, in a sense. Now, if we say Sri Aurobindo and the mother have opened, that would be one thing. But we could even say nature in her universal aspiration has caused this opening to take place. And that opening is now available. And therefore, if human beings are open to it, then that influence can pull us, can draw us.
I mean, that material mother or mother nature, whoever, I mean, that Loba was referring to, can it also be termed as the mother of ignorance instead of putting, specifying it as matter or life, or it was actually matter?
No, you see, the mother in her statement puts two terms right at the beginning. That's what makes it so interesting. That's why I feel it is not merely mother of matter, but it is the mother, like what you're talking, mother of ignorance. It is the whole power of the mother. It is what we may call Kali herself. That's why she's saying, material mother, mother nature, thou hast said thou wilt collaborate. So mother nature is the entire, you know, consciousness of avidya, which is, you know, in a sense, prakriti, avidya prakriti, whose basis is matter. Matter is the basis. Out of matter, all these things must come. So they must be material powers, materialized life, materialized mind. Now, materialized supermind, if matter does not accept it, or it does not emerge out of matter as her own, then it will be a freak. So now that possibility of its being a freak is no longer the case, because the principle has been invoked in the material, you know, density of nature itself.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
So it is the paragraph after the one about the psychic being, right? If the psychic entity has been...
Yeah, correct.
Okay. If the psychic entity has been from the beginning unveiled and known to its ministers, not a secluded king in a screened chamber, the human evolution would have been a rapid soul outflowering, not the difficult, checkered and disfigured development it now is. But the veil is thick and we know not the secret light within us, the light in the hidden crypt of the heart's innermost sanctuary. Intimations rise to our surface from the psyche, but our mind does not detect their source. It takes them for its own activities, because before even they come to the surface, they are clothed in mental substance. Thus, ignorant of their authority, it follows or does not follow them according to its bent or turn at the moment. If the mind obeys the urge of the vital ego, then there is little chance of the psyche at all controlling the nature or manifesting in us something of its secret spiritual stuff and native movement. Or if the mind is overconfident to act in its own smaller light, attached to its own judgment, will and action of knowledge, then also the soul will remain veiled and quiescent and wait for the mind's further evolution. For the psychic part within us, there to support the natural evolution, and the first natural evolution must be the development of body, life and mind successively, and these must act each in its own kind or together in their ill-assorted partnership in order to grow and have experience and evolve. The soul gathers the essence of all our mental, vital and bodily experience and assimilates it for the further evolution of our existence in nature. But this action is occult and not obtruded on the surface. In the early material and vital stages of the evolution of being, there is indeed no consciousness of soul. There are psychic activities, but the instrumentation, the form of these activities are vital and physical, or mental when the mind is active. For even the mind, so long as it is primitive or is developed but still too external, does not recognize their deeper character. It is easy to regard ourselves as physical beings or beings of life or mental beings using life and body and to ignore the existence of the soul altogether. For the only definite idea that we have of the soul is of something that survives the death of our bodies. But what this is, we do not know. Because even if we are conscious sometimes of its presence, we are not normally conscious of its distinct reality, nor do we feel clearly its direct action in our nature.
So, in a way, here he is talking about the individual case where a similar thing to what we were saying about nature yoga is also going on. This is the aspect of the individual that is related to nature yoga. So, Lopa, when you were talking about whether the human nature also follows the action of material nature, here is a certain justification for at least part of it, which is that this nature that we have, which is a physical, vital, mental combination, is also undergoing its own evolution. It's part of the evolution of nature. And Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that indeed these instruments must be developed to a certain degree before they can be adequate to the intimations of the soul. But at the same time, even as they are becoming more adequate, they are also developing a greater sense of their self. This is where the ego comes in. At each level, the ego is established. There is a physical ego, a vital ego, and a mental ego. And as we were reading earlier, the seat of the ego is ultimately in the buddhi and travels, as it were, from there to these other locations. Now, that sense of the individual, as it grows, it develops in the nature, even though the nature may be adequate, a sense of its independence and a sense of its right of independence. So that when it is probably adequate as an instrument, most adequate, it is least ready to listen to the intimations that, you know, are being given to it. This is part of the irony, again, of the human condition. And so Sri Aurobindo is saying that given the very condition of evolution of nature, this must happen. If this was not the case, and it's almost close to the surface, then our existence, our evolution would have been a swift outflowering. But this being the case, it's a troubled struggle. Anything that comes as an intimation immediately changes its nature at the level at which it comes. Mind, which gives us a sense of conscious existence, is the power which really has to acknowledge or accept at the level of conscious will these actions from the soul. But here there are two problems that intervene. One is the problem of the mistranslation of substance. That is, the substance of psychic consciousness is translated into mental consciousness. In that translation, it loses a good deal of its reality. It just becomes of the coin, of the mint of the mental coin. And there it dwells in a certain relativity with other kinds of opinions, thoughts, desires, attitudes, orientations, etc. The other problem is that appropriation of the sense of self. So appropriation of the sense of self is that the mental ego takes it to be one of its ideas. So right, these two factors, the problem of attitude of the mind, instead of being receptive to the activity of the soul, takes on a sense of its ownership. And instead of allowing itself to be transformed by the quality of soul consciousness, instead modifies the soul consciousness and, you know, takes away from it its superior quality, turns it into some kind of grey relativity of mental opinion. So what of the soul? This is the real question he leaves us with at the end of this paragraph. He gives us a sense of the tremendous difficulty of bringing the soul to the front. So what about the soul's existence in man? This is also part of that question that he has raised in the previous chapter about the evolution of the spiritual man. The truly spiritual part in us, can it emerge in its truth? Can it emerge in its own consciousness? And can it emerge as the leader, the king, as he says over here, the hidden king? Can that really emerge in its own right? So first we have to ask the question, to what extent are we aware of it? And this question is asking a general sense of human beings and human history. Throughout the history of humanity, and even at present, to what extent are we aware of it? How does it represent itself to us? It represents itself to us in two ways. One is as a sense of persistence. So as he says here, at first, the only definite idea we have of the soul is of something that survives the death of our bodies. One of the things about human life is that death is alien to us. See, that's the great answer to the yaksha that Yudhishthir gives to the yaksha of the lake when he asks him, what is the most amazing thing on earth? He says, the most amazing thing is that all human beings die, but we conduct our lives as if we will never die. Now, this is a very profound statement. And it has many different interpretations and degrees of understanding to it, this paradox. But one of its degrees of understanding is that death is alien to an inner part of our being. We cannot really understand what it means to die. Death is only an appearance, an experience of the physical being and an appearance of the physical senses. So the experience of the inner being cannot really understand it. See, that the reason is that something we intuit is immortal. That intuition is inbuilt into us. That immortal part is the soul. So that is one basic or fundamental intimation of the soul that humanity carries as an intuition within itself. Even though it may not acknowledge it, it has it. The second one is that humankind has some natural idealisms. Apart from, you know, our being told that to live harmoniously together, we must lead ethical lives. We must not step on other people's toes because otherwise we'll get shot or taken to prison or whatever, or beaten up. There is, apart from that, a certain ought to things. And that ought is magnetized by some kind of ideals, a world of ideals. Where does that come from? So these are the intuitions of the soul that we carry in an intuitive sense inside us. So the most basic thing that Sri Aurobindo is pointing out, people don't usually even acknowledge that. But what Sri Aurobindo is saying is putting his finger on something very fundamental, that even if we don't admit it to ourselves, we carry it as an intuition within us, that there is something immortal in the being. And that is the soul.
So to just intuit the fact that we have something immortal in us, one has to have a certain amount of mental development. Right? Bajita, you there? Sita, you are echoing a lot. Devashita, you there? I don't know. Can anyone hear me?
You're breaking up, and I think Sita, I'm trying to change
something. Yeah, Sita, Ram, you're breaking up.
I'm hearing clearly.
Okay. But we can't hear Debashish.
I'm sorry, I was muted.
Oh, okay. Order.
Took a long time. Okay.
Yeah. I was giving all
for quite
lectures.
A while.
So I agree that a certain mental development has to take place. In fact, the sense of the immortality of the soul is not only intuited by the mind, but intuited by the vital as well. It's the inner consciousness. Even that's partly the reason why the mind does not admit it. Part of the mind has its own existence, and mental consciousness has its own type of consciousness. Therefore, that's the reason why if you ask a person, common person, in today's world, whether they think some part of their being exists after death, they'll tell you no. It's rather better to, and you know, lots of people I know who actually feel that this is just a cultural thing for Indians to believe. That rather small minority of the world, Indians or Hindus or Buddhists, you know, believe this. The rest of the people don't believe it. It's just a matter of belief. So mind has its own trap. You see, mental development has its own kind of problem that it brings to this thing. But deeper down, say the inner mind or the inner vital subliminal parts of the being, they have this sense. That's the reason why if you don't bring people already into a belief system and just were to just find a person without telling that person that we have any existence beyond death, such a person would have difficulty in accepting that there isn't anything immortal in us. The proof of this is in human childhood itself. All human children find death to be an extremely alien thing. They can't believe that one day human beings will die. That sense that one day we will die, what does it mean? That meaning is not there. Even in adults, that meaning is not there concretely. So we are talking about an inner part of the consciousness, say the inner mind, inner vital consciousness, which receives this kind of sense and lives in this sense. As soon as you exteriorize it into the outer mind, you can say all kinds of things and make it into a belief.
Mm-hmm. That is what Sri Aurobindo is saying, is one practice of enlarging the mind. Like quieten it and listen to the intuitions.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Rather to trust that part of the being. If we are to, live in our own deepest intuitions, that would be a beginning to come to contact with the existence of the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that I think was the topic of the previous chapters, huh? The spiritual man.
Yeah.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Okay. Sure.
Keka, you want to read?
Hello. As the evolution proceeds, nature begins slowly and tentatively to manifest our occult parts. She leads us to look more and more within ourselves, or sets out to initiate more clearly recognizable intimations and formations of them on the surface. The soul in us, the psychic principle, has already begun to take secret form. It puts forward and develops a soul personality, a distinct psychic being to represent it. This psychic being remains still behind the veil in our subliminal part, like the true mental, the true vital, or the true or subtle physical being within us. But, like them, it acts on the surface life by the influences and intimations it throws up upon that surface. These form part of the surface, these form part of the surface aggregate, which is the conglomerate effect of the inner influences and upsurgings. The visible formation and superstructure, which we ordinarily experience and think of as ourselves. On this ignorant surface, we become dimly aware of something that can be called a soul, as distinct from mind, life or body. We feel it not only as our mental idea or vague instinct of ourselves, but as a sensible influence in our life and character and action. A certain sensitive feeling for all that is true and good and beautiful, fine and pure and noble. A response to it, a demand for it, a pressure on mind and life to accept and formulate it in our thought, feelings, conduct, character, is the most usually recognized, the most general and characteristic, though not the sole sign of this influence of the psyche. Of the man who has not this element in him, or does not respond at all to this urge, we say that he has no soul. For it is this influence that we can most easily recognize as a finer or even a diviner part in us, and the most powerful for the slow turning towards some aim at perfection in our nature.
So, this is the second level of our recognition of some psychic element within us. So, the first level, the level of the existence of something immortal within us, is at an even more basic or rudimentary stage. In fact, that is the first intimation before, it's a kind of a receptive intimation, before any active power of the soul is experienced. The fundamental property of the soul as a receptive influence on the nature is sense. Now beyond that, as Sri Aurobindo is saying, that there is a gradual development of the soul personality or the psychic being. Psychic being makes its appearance with the human being. Because psychic being finds human prakriti as the basic prerequisite for its self-consciousness. Psychic self-consciousness takes on a body which is hand in glove with human prakriti possibility. So it has a subtle physical nature, a vital nature, and a mental nature to it as a soul personality. Now similarly, our inner being has these kinds of prakritis to it. A true physical, a subtle physical, that term also the mother uses for the physical. She says, there is a true physical. The true physical is the subtle physical. Then there is the inner vital, or what he calls the true vital, which is not just the inner vital. In fact, the true vital and the true mental are ways by which he refers to the mental and the vital purusha. So these beings, these formations of a higher life, a higher consciousness in the nature are hidden from us. Yet they are acting in our surface. They are sending their messages to the surface. Similarly, the psychic being, which is the innermost self, the ultimately, the crystallization of our sense of self is also sending its intimations onto the surface. It may send its intimations also into each of these prakritic parts, the inner mind, the inner vital, and the inner physical nature. The point over here that he's making is that what we call ourselves, our ego, is actually a kind of amalgam of all these various forces and influences that are operating on the surface. They are all a conglomerate, he says. He uses both terms, agglomerate and conglomerate. He says, these form part of the surface aggregate, rather, which is the conglomerate effect of the inner influences and upsurgings, the visible formation and superstructure which we ordinarily experience and think of as ourselves. So here, whatever it is that we take ourselves to be, there is a certain sense of character that emerges. Within that sense of character, there is some kind of quality that we start distinguishing, which is not purely mental, vital, or physical. And that, he says, is experienced by us as something which is a sensitiveness to all that is true, good, and beautiful, fine, pure, and noble. So these ideals, in their own right, not as dictated either by mind or by vital or physical, to the extent that we express these in their own right, we can experience them in ourselves and in others. That's why he's saying the common understanding of soul starts emerging as these properties is in nature. Those who express these properties are said to have a soul. Those who don't are said to have no soul. That statement that Sri Aurobindo is making is not a statement of truth as such. It is a statement of an empirical statement, a statement of what we do normally. Of the man who has not this element in him or does not respond at all to this urge, we say that he has no soul. In other words, the psychic influence has no real effect on the surface consciousness. The Prakriti does not respond to the psychic influence. But this is what we recognize in the Prakriti, in the nature, in the expression of the nature. And so that is our second level of identification of soul in the human nature.
So in our intensive, you were saying that one of the ways we know that the psychic is coming to the front is that we feel gratitude. Right? So the gratitude too is one of these noble feelings.
Yeah, you see, what he's talking about, he will also bring out later, in terms of this gradation of psychic feelings that come to the surface. At first, there are these idealisms. The ideal of liberty, the ideal of not only for oneself but for all, the ideal of truth, the ideal of goodness, the ideal of beauty, these are very grand ideals, and that's a sign of the soul. But the very real truth of the soul in its expression is the sense of the divine as the overriding reality of the universe, the whole manifestation as being an expression of the divine. This knowledge is the knowledge of the soul. Nothing else in us has that knowledge in that same way as the soul has it. This is the reason why you find that mind at its height is struck by doubt. It cannot have that surety of the meaning of the universe. Those who feel that just because mind's own appreciation of the order of things gives it a certain kind of, intuition of the divine, they are right because they are getting it from the higher mind plane. See? But along with it, it can equally hold that it is a totally probabilistic universe, that there is that so-called orderedness is a result of chance. So it cannot be sure, it can never have surety of this kind of presence of the divine as the predominant source of all manifestation. This is why we find it even in Savitri, where Ashwapati at the very heights of mental consciousness of overmind, of at least a certain layer of the overmind, experiences what he calls the self of mind, that cosmic purusha of mind, at a certain level we may say, and is affected by the most profound doubt that he ever has felt. Everything becomes unreal to him. While up until that point, he has really got all kinds of knowledge, cosmic knowledge. Suddenly it all falls into a tremendous void of doubt. And that is the beginning of the process by which he enters into the world soul. So there he finds meaning. Idea of meaning, man in search of meaning. What is the meaning of this world? That is only in the hands of the psychic. So psychic is saturated with this sense that this world, or whatever world, whatever manifestation, is a manifestation of the divine. And along with it comes this profound gratitude in that reality, in that knowledge. So those are some of the primary attributes of the psyche, even more than this knowledge of truth, good and beauty, is the knowledge of the primacy of the divine and gratitude towards that. And Sri Aurobindo will bring that out also, that essentially that is, once we start recognizing that, the true expression of the psychic is beginning to be felt in the nature.
I mean, I feel tempted to say that this truth, I mean, the self-evident nature of the truth probably is the ultimate assurance of success, right? Like, for example, when some kind of comfort, some kind of alignment, which we cannot logically explain to its, I mean, to some extent we can explain, but we cannot really exhaust that intuition of alignment or comfort.
Very, very, very.
That is when we say, like, well, it is true, that's why.
Right? Yeah, that's what is meant as a self-evident truth of this reality. Self-evident. There is nothing else that can give its evidence. It is so full of its knowledge of truth, nothing can infect it because it's not derived from any faith. It is the reality itself. It is your own self-knowledge of the fact that you are the divine. The divine has become you. Because this is that what the Gita says, Amsa Sanatana, Purushottama's Amsa Sanatana, and Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta. It is the self-becoming of the Purushottama and the Paraprakriti. That's why it is so saturated with and self-evident truth. That's the reason why Sri Aurobindo, particularly when he formulated his yoga, made this the first limb of the yoga, the coming to the front of the psychic being. Because if that does not happen, there is always the possibility of feeling lost, feeling doubt, getting astray, being led by wrong voices, all these things. But if this comes to the front, then the one thing that one is assured of is that the sense of the divine as a self-evident reality, that nothing is needed to prove, becomes one's companion.
In the Katha Upanishad, there's a whole section where Yama keeps saying at the end, Etad Vai Tat. This is that. So it's
very true.
Sounded that, that is the, he's reminding Nachiketa again and again that this is that self-evident truth.
Very true, very true. Mm. That those lines are absolutely about the self-evidence of truth. Very true. Etad Vai Tat. Very true.
I couldn't hear Loba properly. Can you, Devashish, because it was breaking up. I wanted to hear exactly what...
She's talking about the Katha Upanishad and the last parts of the Katha Upanishad where Nachiketa and Death are talking, and Death gives Nachiketa the knowledge of the psychic being. Actually, he gives the knowledge of immortality, which is, in a sense, exactly what we are talking about, the triple transformation. And in that, but it's given in a way in which nobody, unless we knew Sri Aurobindo, we would not be able to understand that that is the triple transformation. See, it's given in a very esoteric manner. But the first thing that he talks about within it is the truth of the psychic being, that which persists from life to life, this very thing that we're talking about. And there he uses this term, etat vaitat. You know, that self-evident truth, that alone is true, because it is true.
One of the, one shloka from that section of Katha Upanishad is in the beginning of this chapter.
I see.
Adhumaka, the one without smoke, that one. The very first one. See, a conscious being is the center of the self who rules past and future. He is like a fire without smoke. That one must disengage with patience from one's own body.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And the very next one, it's very interesting. He has arranged in such a way, and then Rigveda is confirming, which is much earlier than Katha Upanishad, and intuition in the heart sees that truth.
Exactly. That is exactly what we were talking about, right? That's the psychic intuition, because that's the psychic knowledge.
But there is this whole range of the middle range before we reach the psychic, where there will be a lot of spontaneous suggestions, but it will not come from the truth.
Yes, that's exactly the point he's making over here. That, you know, that and that quotation from the Katha Upanishad also throws light on exactly that. That, you know, that one must disengage with patience from one's body. The process of disengaging is that bringing to the front of the psychic being. That very careful, you know, mm-hmm. putting to silence of the other voices and tuning one's ear only to this one to develop that inner tact of knowing that particular quality of self-evidence. If one has a strong experience of it, then of course that quality becomes much more easy to recognize. But otherwise the nature has to be really purified. That's where Shuddhi comes in, the purification of the nature, so as to allow that to come to the front.
In Rigveda class we have been reading about this Antariksha. So this Antariksha, I was thinking that it's everywhere, at every granule, in every, all of our experiences with the world. So basically the self-evidence can be an assurance or that no matter what, it will find itself. So basically, of course, sincerity is the utmost important here. But at the same time, it needs the comfort of that assurance, right?
Yeah, true.
And also, I mean, it is reminding of me of that, I mean, though it is a little irrelevant maybe, that Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade that had at the very end the getting that drink to become immortal, that when he was going through different steps, there was a point where it is just seemed impossible that you almost have to sort of step on a on vacuum, like on total empty. And then he kept at, you know, chanting that, you know, it's the faith which you have to depend on. And then he puts the step forward, and when he completed that faith, the whole staircase or whatever, the whole path was actually materially open to him. But that, he had to first take that step in that antariksha, in other words. So basically, it's like something internal has to happen before that external thing will open, right?
Yeah, very true, very true. This, very true. That's why ultimately, from a certain point of view, the whole yoga can be seen, or at least the entire, you know, maybe the first major part of the yoga is completed. At least maybe the psychic transformation, one sign of it is that no expectation other than the purity of faith in the divine is our motive force. There is no other power that is motivating us except faith in the divine. That is one's pure, absolutely pure motive. There is nothing else. I think that is really, you know, what you were saying about that particular symbolic act is also related to that. That's also a sign of the psyche coming to the front, that there is no other motive. That's another definition of purity, in fact, that the mother also gives. Definition of purity mother gives in one place is to be open to no influence other than the divine. Another way you can put it is to have faith in the divine as one's motive and nothing else. So then one finds that, you know, none of the other voices come because one is fueled only by faith.
Yeah, but that motive, I mean, that purity of the motive will, is also some kind of thing that gets developed by, you know, it's not necessarily always the sunlit path, right?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. So that's why, you know, that's why I was pointing out that all those chapters in the synthesis of yoga that have to do with Shuddhi are very relevant here, actually. That is the purification. In the sense that Sri Aurobindo and the mother give it, that is very necessary as a prerequisite to the emergence of the soul.
Debashita, just a step back. So we are doing the triple transformation here, and we know that there is a previous stage called the development of the yogic consciousness. So I would think that is what he discussed in the previous chapter of this, the spiritual man, right? To develop the antakarana.
Yeah, he touches on it, but not really, you see, because this is a philosophical work.
Mm.
So here he is laying out, this is the major work in which he lays it out in terms of the three transformations. But he's making it very clear that you know, it's not so easy. The first transformation itself, we can easily get misled unless we make sure that it emerges. So here, in fact, he's talking about the stages, how the inner being, he will talk about the whole antakarana. Very soon, he'll talk about the, you know, the subliminal being, the inner being, and the inner mental, vital, physical, and all that. He will also bring in over here at this point. Previous chapter, he was talking more about, in general terms, about the evolution of the spiritual man. In other words, something must emerge in us, whether it is the Atma, or it is the psychic being, or it is the Brahmic consciousness. Something must emerge in us, which is an aspect of pure spirit. Mm-hmm. That's the point he was making in the previous
mm-hmm.
chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So long as we are within Prakriti, and talking about the spirit, the evolution of the spiritual man has not occurred.
Mm-hmm.
This is the point he was making. Here he's saying that evolution of spiritual man is something that must be accompanied by the completion of nature's yoga. And for that to happen, there is a certain way in which it must occur. It must occur through what he calls the structural transformation.
So here he has sort of included the development of the yogic consciousness in these discussions. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much, I don't remember well, but what you said was the development of the antakarana, right?
Development of the antakarana, the purification of the inner instrument, the antakarana, the emergence of the mental purusha, you see, these are the parts he's talking about there in synthesis as preparatory to the sure emergence of the psychic being.
Mm-hmm.
So if the mental purusha becomes sufficiently active and can distinguish or discriminate between all these actions of the desires in the nature, in the prakriti, that can help to keep the inner instrument pure. See? So purification of the inner instrument is something which can be aided a lot by the austerity of the mental purusha. And in that, the psychic flame can shine, can be lit, and can shine, and can conform the whole process. You see, once that becomes established, then one is safe, so to say.
And mental purusha, here he uses the word the true mind.
Yes, still not fully talked about it. He just introduced the fact that there is a true mind, a true vital, and a true physical. But he will talk about it further as we go on in this chapter.
And the inner mind, inner vital, inner physical are actually the pure prakriti part of these instruments.
Yeah, okay. Correct.
Okay, Debashita, shall we end here today?
Before that, I want to ask actually here, Lopa or Debashish, that emergence of yogic consciousness and the triple transformation, this I found very interesting. That yogic consciousness, did you refer to as the aspiration or some kind of waking up?
Good point. Actually, see, what Lopa is talking about, we had discussed this in the first intensive on record of yoga. This idea he's actually introduced in Synthesis of Yoga. In fact, there is a chapter in Yoga of Works called the Yoga of Works in the Supermind. I think something like that it is called. And there he is talking about four transformations. He's saying there have to be four transformations. And basically, the first one he's mentioning is what he calls the development of the yogic consciousness. Now, development of the yogic consciousness he is describing in terms of the purification of the inner nature and the emergence of the mental purusha. So, it is almost as if that has to precede. Now, he is saying that they don't have to complete themselves. It's not that first you have to completely achieve totally pure inner consciousness and complete emergence of mental purusha, but that has to precede that those steps have to start off, and that will make it much easier for the next steps to occur. The second step is the contact with the psychic being and the emergence of the psychic being, then transformation of the nature by the psychic being, or that psychic transformation. Then the third one is cosmic, and the fourth one is the supramental. But that in that formulation, I think, you know, what happens when people talk about triple transformation, that already the psychic transformation needs so much preparation that is lost sight of. And people start thinking that this is the first step, you know, we've already got it, or God knows what. So that's why he makes a very clear thing about that purification and emergence of the mental purusha. Because mental purusha's emergence can help to maintain the purity of the inner instrument. See, that observation and ability to discriminate and reject. See, aspiration, rejection, surrender. The aspiration and the surrender belong to the psychic being. But the rejection must also accompany it and probably precede it. And that is achieved through this first of the development of the yogi consciousness, as he calls it. Then, or as that proceeds, psychic being also starts emerging. Fire is lit, and it, you know, can emerge safely.
Okay, so basically, since mind is a very powerful one amongst these three, physical, vital, and mental, so it can, its own sincerity can be an aid in this transformation work.
Yeah, its sincerity and its ability to discriminate. Yeah, exactly. As the mental Purusha emerges, it can witness without being touched. You see, that sense of freedom is much greater. Development of the yogic consciousness implies that something in us is free from the determinations of Prakriti. That free power can observe the movements of Prakriti and can reject the false movements because it's able to discriminate that these movements are coming from some inferior motive. So it keeps the temple clean. As he says, if you want to the divine to manifest in the temple, you must first keep the temple clean. That keeping the temple clean is aided first by the emergence of the yogi consciousness, which is a power of mental Purusha to purify the inner being.
I mean, would it be fair to say that it is actually understanding, I mean, I'm trying to refresh so that I understand. So, that basically understanding the fuzziness of or external understanding or external phenomenal experiences. Like, fuzziness in the sense that the way ego understands it, there is a fuzziness somewhere, right? Some kind of obscurity.
Exactly. So, over here, like what we read, the last paragraph, he's talking exactly about that fuzziness. He's saying that all these messages are coming to the surface and the understanding is clouded. So that understanding can only be unclouded by two means. One is if the psychic being becomes very powerful, then it can give us a clear light of discrimination from within. And, it, you know, that can be a sure guide. But it's like a catch-22 situation because psychic being itself is not so close to the surface and is not so powerful that it can have an influence on the surface nature. So mind being something that in some sense is more developed in us, closer to the surface, I mean, that's also a relative thing. In most people, it is not so close to the surface. But at least we can do something about it. We can try to release it and make it into a pure instrument. Use the buddhi as a channel of a discrimination to you purify the nature, get rid of all these mixtures, what you're calling the fuzziness, keep it in a state of equality so that the psychic can emerge in its purity.
Thank you.
Shall we end here with the meditation?